here's the thing. I would rather just pick death. I'm like a total wimp. Like, I am not a survivor in that way. I'm like, you know what? Cat me out. Give me the cyanide pill. Or like throw me in the garage with the engine running. And I pick death. Yeah.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f**ks given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of the Under Embargo podcast. I'm Parry Hedrick, your co-host, along with Becca Chambers. Today, we have our second guest on the show, who is Robin Daniels. He is the Chief Business Officer of Zensai. He also has a pretty illustrious track record as CMO and very big marketing titles at companies we all have heard of, like LinkedIn, Matterport, WeWork, and it goes on from there. So I just want to say welcome to you, Robin, to the Under Embargo podcast.
Thanks, Parry and Becca. Hey, good to see you. Super excited to be here. Honestly, I love the what you two are putting out there. I love the vibe. So excited to be here for you.
Awesome. So awesome. I want to get right to you. What is a chief business officer? So that's the new title that I haven't really heard. And as you explain what that is, I'd be curious to know how that sort of differentiates from your long pedigree of CMO type roles.
Well, I'll tell you what I do. I do business. Very important. You know, this, when I was a kid, I always wanted to do business. You know, I'm kidding. Chief business officer, basically, the idea behind it is I love the art of marketing. It's my passion. It's what I've been doing for a long time. But I also wanted to expand my own kind of growth and my own, you know, challenge myself in new areas. And I just thought I didn't want to do the same thing over and over and over again. And so I thought, well, how can I expand from there? And I think I've thought a lot about, do I become a CEO? Do I become a COO? Do I become a chief growth officer, whatever? And I think they all kind of have their upsides and downsides, honestly, in terms of their titles. And a COO to me is very kind of like, to me, it sounds very internally focused. That's focused on finance and legal and HR and stuff like that. And that's just not my superpower. My superpower is to go to market storytelling, category creation, communications, all that kind of stuff, how to build an epic brand. But I wanted to take on more than marketing because I also getting like wanted to challenge myself. So I had a long discussion with the CEO of the company I'm at now, Zensai. And we just had an open discussion about like what would be the right thing to call me, you know, and how should we kind of partner up together. And I said, I want to really kind of take on everything that's external focused. Anything has to do with go-to-market is kind of how I define it. And the cool thing about this kind of nebulous title, Chief Business Officer, is that it means everything and nothing. Because everything you do in a company is supposed to about the business, which means that basically you can shove anything under the Chief Business Officer, which it's ended up, you know, right now. So the things I run directly today is that pre and post sales, product, and marketing. So we actually have a chief revenue officer, Kathy. She's amazing. She runs like the revenue part of it. But I run those kind of three teams under me. But you can put anything under a chief business officer. But that was the goal. I still love marketing. I'm still heavily involved in marketing. But it's not the only thing I want to be defined as a human being or as a career professional.
That makes sense. And that's a good overview. So I guess a quick question would be, can you give us like a minute on what Zensai does so folks understand what the company is? And then can you talk a little bit about how, if at all, you interface or interact with the communications piece or if that's under your purview?
Yeah, absolutely. So Zensai, we consider ourselves the human success company. And what that means is that we are basically building a platform that's all about how do we make people the best that they can be every single day through the learning skills, knowledge, and motivation that you can get. Like, and I think about this, that 70% of people in most jobs, they're unhappy. They want to quit their jobs. And we want to be the antidote to that. We want to be the platform that pushes people every day a little bit to get the right knowledge and skills, to get the right motivation, to feel like you're achieving something a little bit more every day. Kind of like the Atomic Habits, like getting 1% better every day so you feel like there's momentum in your life towards something that fulfills you, gives you joy and purpose, but not just for altruistic reasons, but because it also benefits the companies that you work for. So we want to be that platform that's all about making you the best that you can be every single day.
I love that. For real. Like that is, I mean, just from like a leadership perspective, like when you invest in employees, they invest in the company, right? It is such like a like benefit to all, win-win-win.
Yes,
and
yes,
people
yes,
are like, well, if you train employees, then they're going to leave and take that knowledge elsewhere. And it's like, but while they're here, they're going to do better work. And if you treat them well, maybe they won't
That's
leave, right? Maybe
That's
they'll
right.
stay. And this is like one, another hill I will die on. The like,
and me too.
If I invest in people, then they're going to get better, and or that's threatening to me as a manager, right? Like whatever. That's
well, it's also it's this is why it's fully aligned with what my North Star in life is anyway, to becoming kind of like the best that you can be and have a life full of joy and purpose and fulfillment. Because when I think about the 70% of people who are showing up every day not feeling fulfilled or joyful or like they're doing anything that's meaningful, I can guarantee you those people are not doing the best work of their life. They're just not. And I just think it's such a sad indictment. I don't want to live in that world. Really. I want to live in a world where ideally people are motivated and fueled by the work that they do in a way that's deeply inspiring. And it's, again, it's both because I'm a dreamer in some ways, but it's also because I think if we want to solve the challenges that we have in society on a macroeconomic level and a global level, we need everybody to show up every day inspired and motivated. I mean, all a company really is, whether it's a small company or a big company, is a collection of people trying to solve challenges together, right? Sometimes those are like small mundane challenges, and sometimes they're really big epic challenges as we've probably all been through. But all of this is a collection of people trying to do that. And if you don't have that trust and joy and camaraderie and kind of like purpose together, it's very hard to like do great work, I think. So I want to see if I can at least get people a little bit more on that path towards that. Just for their own kind of satisfaction and happiness.
Everybody that's seen you on LinkedIn, and you and I have been sort of friends in the same orbit for a long, long while, but anybody who's seen you and your posts, I think they all probably have a similar takeaway, which was that you're a guy who's generally pretty optimistic, glasses half full, which leads me into a question that we didn't discuss prior to this, which is, to what extent is empathy sort of a piece of how you manage people and how you bake that into the ethos of the companies that you work with? Is that a trite sort of overused word, or does that have meaning for you in a way that's applicable?
I think it's everything, honestly. I mean, that's kind of how I think I try to lead from the front with my heart. Because I think if you want to get the best out of people, you have to understand their motivation, and everybody's motivation is different at different points in their lives. I'm sure it probably has been for you. There was a point in my life when I chased titles and money and outcomes, and now I'm chasing fulfillment and happiness and joy and so on. But unless you understand what motivates people and you have the empathy around why they're motivated by the things that they are, then I think it's very hard to get people to do great work. Because if you just treat everybody with the same brush, I think you're going to miss out a lot on the deeper motivation. And I think people, you really unlock the full character of people and the full potential of them when you can dig deep into what motivates them. So when I was at LinkedIn for a few years ago, for example, we did this exercise. I had a team of roughly about 50 people, a lot of people coming together, new people. I was a new leader there. And I brought them all together in an offsite. And one of the questions that I said that I wanted to do as an icebreaker is have everybody show up with a picture that they could choose themselves. And on that picture, they should put their why. Like, why are you doing what you're doing? And it was much more heartwarming and eye-opening than I even kind of had anticipated kind of setting this up. And there were tears and there were laughter and so on, but people were coming up and they were standing in front of the 50 people sharing, I'm in it because I want to make my mom proud, or I'm in it because I hated being poor when I was growing up. It's like these deep motivations, but unless you understand that, I think it's very hard to like build the trust and camaraderie and also get that person towards a path that's motivational for them. If you grew up in wealth, then trying to motivate somebody with money doesn't matter really, right? Because that's not the thing. Maybe that's more around feeling like you're part of something and you're achieving something, versus if you've grown up with nothing, then maybe, yeah, the money is actually a big part of like what fuels your every day. So I think the empathy of that understanding, so one of the first things I do when I come into a new company is try to spend a lot of time with each of the people on the team to get to know them beyond the surface level of just what they do at work, to get that empathy, yeah.
That is an amazing exercise, by the way, the asking people what motivates them, because you're right. It is for everybody. It's totally different. And I do think that I think fulfillment right now for people goes a really long way. Like, I think people would choose a pay cut in exchange for an awesome manager who let them work in the way that they needed to work and really drive outcomes and feel like they knew what they were contributing every day, right? I think about the times when I grinded my team the hardest, which I really try not to do, but you know, in comms, it ebbs and flows and you have, we're leading up to a brand launch and I feel like we were working round the clock, day in and day out. And nobody complained. We loved it because we knew that we were building something super important. We felt so much joy in it. We were building this baby that it felt like, you know what? I don't care if I'm grinding because we're in this together. Right. We're in the trenches. And it was, I mean, I still, like when we launched it, I still feel like that was one of the proudest moments of my whole life because we had gone through war together to come out and it was best, you know?
Well, that's why this is why it's so interesting. There's so many books written about motivation and drive and all. And of course, there's a lot of complexity and factors that goes into that. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think there's really kind of three core things. And without them, you can have everything else, but won't get to that magic that you're just describing. Number one is, do you have a shared purpose that you're fighting for? And sometimes that's the big company mission, and sometimes it's just the small team mission. I want to show up for my team every day to make sure that they are proud of the work that we're doing collectively together. This is esprit de corps that I think is so important. The second thing is, do you feel like you're making a difference towards that stated goal? It's really hard to feel motivated if you're just doing busy work. Like you get to that Friday night and you're like, shit, I was busy, but I actually don't know if I achieved anything or made a difference.
Why are we doing this?
Like we've all had those weird things, like it's horrible. The hamster wheel, right? The worst is like that Friday night feeling when you're with your family, you're talking to them about, hey, I was busy by the end of the year. And then the third thing is, are you doing it with good people? Like where you can laugh and have some smiles and you know, fun and so on. It doesn't mean that every day is like that. There's lots of tense moments, I'm sure, in building any business, as I'm sure we all have tried, but do you trust each other? Can you laugh together? I remember again, there was a colleague I worked with and it was right during a time of heightened political correctness. And he came to me kind of like, he was a little sad because he's like, he always used humor as a way to kind of like build trust and camaraderie. And he had a team of about, he worked for me and he had a team maybe of about 15 people under me. And he was like, he was finding it really difficult to like, how do you do that? Because part of that struggle is how do you connect as human beings? And if you take away a lot of this, it becomes really hard to do. But I think it's purpose. I think it's impact. And I think it's people. Those are the three core things. Without them, you're screwed. Yeah.
You started to touch on something actually, like as a manager, when you're managing through political turmoil, I worked at a company where we had Russian and Ukrainian employees at the same time when the war broke out, right? Like that is a very sensitive thing that nobody has trained me how to do. I don't know how to deal with this. Yeah. And yet I am one of the people who is tasked with helping navigate the business through this situation, right? And I think the empathy piece is the thing that ties everybody together in that, right? Like that's the one thing we know is that we have to be like people first focused in order to navigate through this on a business level. And you said something else that I was going to touch on, but I totally lost it with my ADD brain. So, yeah.
World. No, but it's those moments that really test. I mean, I'll be honest, in the spirit of under embargo and vulnerability, like the time when the Black Lives Matters moment was happening, that was super tough. And I was really trying to be empathetic and show up for my team because everybody was really like hurting during that time. But I can't get around the fact that I'm a white male leader, you know, and like I'm trying to show up in the best way that I can. I was fully empathizing, I think, with the situation and how horrible it was and how unjust it was. But I can't get around the fact of the way that I look. And I was always kind of conscious of that, of course, right, in some way. And I'm like, I just kept reminding myself, just trying to do the best that I can every day. Right? Like that's the only thing.
I remember what I was going to say. You reminded me. And that is that as a manager, nobody warns you the amount of emotional labor that you're putting into your job. I was during these, like wrecked, crying, right? Because you feel, and especially if your team is tight, especially if you have really a lot of psychological safety within your team and you're the manager who is carrying the weight of whether it's team drama or world drama or am I showing up right in this moment and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, I've had jobs where I felt like half of my time was spent just kind of acting almost as a therapist, but then I was, nobody's therapizing me. Like, it's hard,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's exactly. It's really hard. It's emotionally hard. That's why I always think about marketing and comms, honestly, in general. It's the highest highs, but it's also the lowest lows. It's just the truth of it. It's in all my experience, yeah, when things are going well, it's the best place in the world to be because you can have so much fun with it. It's the most creative outlet and you can impact so many people's lives. But when things are not going well, whether that's outside of your control or maybe the market's turning or whatever it is, it's really tough because then marketing or comms oftentimes gets the blame for the majority of things that are going wrong.
Or they're asked to solve things that they can't possibly solve themselves.
Exactly.
So we've talked a lot about, you know, difficult situations, navigating difficult times and all of that. And you mentioned earlier, Robin, that different things motivate different people. And you did that session where people were, you know, getting emotional and teary about, you know, why they do what they do. What motivated you to become kind of the man you are now? What, you know, I know our backgrounds are a little similar. What was the motivating factor for you to punch probably way above your weight class at the time?
I've always been an insecure overachiever in many ways, I think. For those of you who don't know, Perry and I actually lived parallel lives. There was 3 years ago, he was doing a tour across Europe. And literally 2 days later, I was in the exact same spot. We were sending each other pictures of us in the exact same spot on that tour. It was really funny. I'm like, I'm basically just copying your lives. I want to be Perry.
You're my vacation ganger.
I know. I want to be Perry when I grow up. So I think you and I share parallel lives in many ways. But no, it comes from, I grew up, and I think it's well documented in Copenhagen, Denmark. I grew up to very hippie-ish parents, you know, my mom and dad, but very dysfunctional and very poor. And we always had to struggle. And I always saw that the struggle, just how much it limits your ability to choose the lives that you want to live. Even though my parents had great idealistic dreams of what they wanted their lives to be, it never kind of materialized because I think they were always too dysfunctional or too disorganized or not good enough in whatever skill set they needed at the moment to kind of like navigate themselves out of it. And so I've always kind of been, my way of getting out of that and kind of rising is just by pure determination, I think, and persistence. I'm not somebody who gives up easily. I try to set myself really big goals. Like I said, by the time I'm 35, I wanted to be a CMO, for example, and I just made it, you know. But it's like always setting myself like, check, I just always just kind of trying to set myself goals because I didn't go to Stanford or Harvard. I didn't come up from a background of wealth and privilege. So my superpower was always just kind of the way I work really hard, but it came from a way in essence, I've always wanted the freedom to live my life the way I wanted to. And that's why I, choose the jobs that I have. Sometimes they have not worked out, obviously. I think it's also been documented. Like WeWork is a great example. At some point in time, I was worth a lot of money when I was there, and it turned into out to be nothing.
Sure.
But I've always chosen things where I can both have fun in the job, but also, of course, have a great outcome at some point. I don't think one is exclusive of the other. But it comes, honestly, the reason I've always been working so hard. It comes from, I think, in some way, this feeling that I still have today, you know, as I'm in my 40s, that it could all just go away. I just know it sounds a little weird because I have had a good career.
I think that's I still really have common thing for people who grow up poor is the feeling of it could all go away in a second. Like I did not, I will say I grew up privileged as hell, but I have a lot of people in my life who did grow up poor. And that is like the common thread is this, like, it could be gone. The anxiety of it could be gone in an instant.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And I don't have that. I don't have that anxiety. And I think that's really interesting.
Oh, I have that. And that's 100% sort of a motivating factor against everything that I do at all times. And it's also why I try to impress upon my kids over and over again, where I came from, to let them know they could also slide back if they're not careful and don't pick the right choices and try to be good humans out in the world. But I want to pivot a little bit from this, which is trying to do the best work we can, driven by whatever the motivating factors are. And I kind of want to parlay that into the idea of brand at some of these companies that we've worked at, you've worked at. There's an argument going on. I asked a recent guest about this, which is that in the CMO seat, there seems to be this discussion about revenue generation versus brand and which has priority. And I'm just curious, across your travels, what have you seen shift and where do you think we have landed on that one?
Okay, I love Becca's reaction to this. Says it all. No, I mean, I think basically, if you think about it, you have three ways of getting customers. You can either pay for their attention, you can get people to be so interested in what you're saying that they come to you organically, or you can get people to find out about you through word of mouth, friendships, networks, and so on, right? And the reason why you have to do all three in marketing is because they work in different timelines, but the quality is completely inverse. So, and versus the quantity. So in digital marketing, you want to pay for people's attention. You get the most volume. It's the most data driven. So everybody loves it, but the quality is always the most shit. And you're going to sift through a lot of crap. And those deals, a lot of times transactional. People do not fall in love by clicking on a 10 word Google ad. This just doesn't happen, right? They have to fall in love with your story over and over again. Organic storytelling, the quality is way higher when you put out stuff that is so interesting, whether that's on TikTok or media or press releases or blog posts or podcasts, whatever. You put out stuff that's so interesting, people say, I want to go learn more. Of course, the quality is going to be much higher. It's just much more unpredictable, which is why it's not
companies. And harder to measure.
Much harder to measure, right? But the quality is obviously way higher. And once you crack that code, you're golden. But that requires one key skill, which I think is lacking a lot in marketing today. And I'll get to that in just a moment. And then the third area is what I would call community marketing or word of mouth based marketing. And in my company, the companies I've been at, Salesforce, LinkedIn, Box, we work the best deals, the most loyal customers, the biggest customers were always the ones that came through our community based efforts. Meaning when we would show up somehow, whether that's a small 2-person dinner or 50-person event, and be able to evangelize and get people to deeply understand what it is that we do. The quality is much higher. They fall in love with who you are and what you do, the story of what you can do for them. They become part of your family, but it's not scalable. That's why, and it takes longer. So that's why it's a harder one to crack. It takes longer, doesn't scale because you have basically, you can't just get in front of a million people that way. So a good marketing plan has to do all three. But if you want to create a super brand, which is the ultimate competitive moat, right? Then you have to really invest in the second and third one around storytelling and around community-based marketing. I don't know of anybody who's really created a super brand by just investing in paying for people's attention, because that attention can go away the moment something better comes along. And there's always going to be something better that comes along. But if you have a brand that people love and feel like they're part of something, whether that's a Patagonia, Nike, Apple, all these brands that we all know, then that becomes the ultimate competitive moat. But for the second one around storytelling, which I think we're in this golden age of storytelling. I love the format of podcast because it's such a great conversation. I love being able to see your faces while we have a fun chat. The great thing about this age is that there are more opportunities than ever to get the story out about who you are and what you do. Whether you want to be on TikTok and do something viral and do podcasts and videos or ads or cat videos or whatever it is, you know, there's all this stuff you can do. However, the downside of being a golden age of storytelling is that there's so much noise out there. I mean, it's just like, if you don't have the courage to stand out, to be different, you're dead in the water. People are just so inundated with information. And authentic, right? Of course. Yes.
That's it. I mean, I was asked, my follow-up question to you was going to be, in the brand, in the 2 second buckets, how important do you think that the human part of the brand matters and the people behind the brands? Because I think that's becoming more important now than it's ever been. And it's going to continue to be, to your point, like putting content out online. You're putting content out from your corporate brand isn't fine. Meh. Putting content out from the people behind your brand is really that matters. Like you said, TikTok now, people are shopping from people on TikTok.
That's crazy. Like they say, man, you live in interesting time. I think you bring up the perfect point. It's all about the people. And maybe it always was, but we kind of lost sight of that in the slew of just trying to shove a message in front of as many people's faces. People fall in love with people at the end of the day. And so it's funny, when you look at my career, I've only ever worked for B2B companies. Right? And some of them, honestly, kind of boring in some ways. But what I learned early in my career is that we should always market ourselves like a consumer company, because consumer companies are just much better at creating an emotional connection to people and getting people to feel something. And so I learned that early on, and that it's always been my playbook. And all the companies I've gone to, like, yes, I know we're selling to businesses and they're spending millions of dollars, but let's market ourselves like a consumer company.
Because that's a differentiator, the right?
And that's usually put, and that usually puts people first, right? And consumer companies do that better versus here's a screenshot of a CRM database and like, oh, so boring, right?
This is my argument with B2B stuff, because I come from B2B also, is like everyone's saying the same thing and is boring as hell. So if somebody just likes your colors better, that might, you know what I mean? Like it really, brand really does matter. Or your CEO is like, has better opinions. Like there is so much psychological stuff that goes into brand that people are just like, oh, it's just about shapes and colors. And it's like, it's really not. It's about the thing that makes people remember you and think, I'll buy this one over that one. You might just have nicer packaging. Right. That could be the difference. Totally. I buy stuff at Target that has nicer packaging because I like cool branding.
This reminds me a little bit of IBM, right? So for many years, everybody's heard, you know, no one gets fired for buying IBM. Mm-hmm. It was reliable. It was trustworthy. You know, your dad bought IBM, like everybody could trust it. And then that worked until it didn't, you know? So there was a whole campaign, I don't know, 10 years ago, where they tried to humanize the brand a little bit because they were taking cues from what was working on the consumer side. Right. So you started to see, I'm an IBMer, showing the actual people behind this big, stodgy, you know, monolith of a company. And that had a lot of mileage. And it actually kind of gave permission for a lot of other B2B companies to start getting a little more experimental and to try to humanize their brands. And I think precious few B2B companies have caught that message and are still doing that today. Yeah. Most, I use this expression, that it's like they're standing atop Mount Olympus in flowing robes, pontificating about the wondrous awesomeness of their deep technology. And no one gives a shit about that. They want to feel something.
B2B brands have like a Wendy's social media, you know, like the funny, followable, whatever. I just follow Wendy's for their snarky takes on
totally.
There are no B2B companies that do that because it's just thought of as ridiculous. And I'm like, I would totally buy from a B2B company that was grilling people online and roasting their competition. Totally.
These are enterprise size deals. We don't make jokes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is also why I think I agree with most of it. I think still the this is why it starts really at the leadership level, because you have to push the leadership to do this because it gives everybody else permission to show up as themselves, right? Because you can, yes, you can go and do the IBM thing and sponsor, and you can start putting your people in front in ads and so on, but it's still a little bit not fully authentic. We have this golden age where it's like, you can show up and people don't remember exactly. Like Prerna, you and I know each other for a long time and I follow you religiously because you post great content. I have no idea what you posted last week. It's just the consistency of you showing up as yourself, your dorkiness, your hot takes, your sometimes stupid takes. It's all good. I enjoy it all because, you know, just like it's so uniquely you. And that's made me fall in love with who you are and what you stand for, right? It's just that consistency. And I think you can try to put it in a corporate app, but it's not the same as you just showing up as yourself every day, right? But once leadership does it, that gives people permission to do the same.
I think this is a logical transition into one of the topics I wanted to cover anyway about you. And likewise, Robin, like you are out there on LinkedIn all of the time and in various jumping poses and very fire behind you, like all these quirky, bizarre things. You're all over the place. And to your point, I don't necessarily know last week or whatever, but I know that you're always there. And exactly. I'm like, this is a guy who's putting himself out there. And by the way, he's going to be top of mind in any kind of economic condition, right? Like good, bad, everybody's going to know who Robin Daniels is. And I think that same ethos should be applying to the brand proper. But please respond to what I just said.
You know, and so I learned this fairly early on. I mean, I started taking my personal brand fairly seriously, I would say probably about 10 years ago. I'm not serious yet. And okay, I'm going to manufacture this. I'm just like starting to put myself more out there. I feel like I'd gotten to the point in my life where I didn't feel like 100% an imposter anymore. I had finished the share from my experience with Salesforce and Box. And I was like, let me start sharing this. So I started sharing a little bit. But in the beginning of that journey, you know, you got to kind of find your voice, like what sounds authentic to you. So it doesn't sound, even some of my first early posts, right, in the first couple of years were probably like, here's Scotty, here's what I've observed, and here's what you, I'm like, oh, it's just so boring, right? And you've learned over time with practice, and it's a great, actually, I think, segue around really communication as well in general. Practice is everything. The more you do something, it's like working out or riding a bike, you just get better and more comfortable with it. And so I learned early on, like I would say about 10 years, I really started ramping this up. And it's a couple of reasons. Of course, I could see my personal value instantly going up from doing this. Like the amount of inbound interest I would get for speaking at events or jobs, you know, that would try to hire me just went up exponentially with the amount of stuff I posted. If it was valuable, people would start contacting me for all kinds of things. Then I also started noticing a really interesting thing that just especially happened when I was at LinkedIn, is that people inside the team, I had a team that was fairly distributed around the world, about 50 people or so, really started paying attention to what I would post every day. And of course, I'm like working at LinkedIn, so I thought maybe that's kind of obvious. But then it really like escalated when I was at WeWork. So suddenly there, I had the biggest team I've ever managed, about 400 people all around the world. And it was so chaotic, that company. I was growing like crazy. But I started noticing that, you know, I wouldn't see a lot of the people all the time, but they would always pay attention to what I would post. And so I just started like making this like the ultimate internal communication tool is actually LinkedIn for me. And because everybody like in engineering and product and finance, I would get these notes all the time, like, hey, I just saw what you posted. It really made my day. Or, oh, I didn't know that you're doing this right now. You're focusing on this. It kind of came like a sneaky way of doing internal comms, because in most companies, you're probably doing all hands every month, right? Maybe some companies do it a little bit more, but usually around once a month. But this here is actually a way of keeping your finger on the pulse for everyone around what's happening every day. So I would say the last kind of 4 or 5 years, my internal model has been very much around, like, I'm very aware that everybody, even at Sensei, a small company, just over 200 people, they all see what I post. I mean, literally, I get so many
awareness. This is an absolute insightful take for comms people right here. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is a leader at a company can put whatever they're thinking, whatever they've worked on, whatever's coming up on LinkedIn, knowing that that is going to get juice externally while informing the people internally and also giving them more of an insight into who you are as a person. So they're like, oh my God. The bosses at my company are awesome. Have you guys seen Robin? Robin's cool. Robin skis. Robin likes this. Like, Robin's dog is cute as hell. Like, 1,000% what you just said. And I wish that more leaders would take advantage of that. And instead of spending 12 hours with your team building in all hands, spend 10 hours building in all hands and spend 2 hours working on content for LinkedIn, right? It's just
exactly.
obvious to me, but I think that is, you nailed it on the head when you said this is the best way for people internally to get to know you, because that's right. And they don't have to feel like it's forced. They can passively consume you and who you are, and you can do a one-to-many personal interaction with people. I love it. I love it.
And they feel like they know me at scale now. It's like, I mean, because I post every day, like I think, yeah, you two do as well. And so it means that every day somebody's getting a little piece of my soul, a little insight into my mind and what I'm thinking about, what's top of mind. You can always tell, like, if I'm writing about team or leadership or culture or marketing, then that's on top of mind for me. Like, it's always, it's a little glimpse into this. Not a day goes by, Becca, where I don't have at least a few people, like a handful of people inside the company say, hey, I saw your post.
Love that.
Like, it's amazing. It's amazing.
I mean, the messages I get from people that are like, I saw this post and it meant this, and strangers and stuff. And I'm just like, that, I mean,
I needed to hear this today. I get that message a lot.
Exactly. Yes. I need to hear this today. Exactly. Yeah. So, but also, it does give that permission, you know, that permission to put everybody else. We've seen a rise in our employees posting because they feel comfortable, because it's not like, well, my boss see it and be like mad about it. They see it and I high five them now, you know? So it becomes a snowball effect, of course, right? Yeah.
So we have a little bit of time left. I wanted to touch on one of the big topics of the day, which is the rippling / fiasco espionage. It's got all the intrigue of you know, of a major motion picture. Uh-huh. Do you have any take on this based on what you've seen? Is it one of those situations where it's like, hey, if you're not cheating, you're not trying? Like, how do you view this whole thing? And, you know, how do you see it shaking out?
I'm just going like, what the actual fuck? Honestly, I think it's kind of embarrassing. I mean, like, it doesn't put, I mean, like tech isn't enough in the crosshairs of being a weird place to work and kind of mercurial. And then you see this shit happening. I'm just like, this is not very cool. Like, there's so many ways you can win in a market. You can win by having a great product, a great culture, a great brand, all the stuff we talked about. And you get them to go do dumb shit like this. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's not kosher. I think it's very short-sighted. And I think it comes back to what I'm fighting against from just the beginning of our conversation. I want to create a world where people are motivated to do great things and ideally together, but it's not growth at all costs or profit at all costs, but it's about impact at all costs. And this here story tells me it's all about profit and growth at all costs, because we will do whatever it takes, the Uber model, the whatever model, right, of old yesterday year to grow.
Like, and whatever, talk about cheating, yeah. Torpedoing your brand in one fell swoop, right? Yeah, like, yeah. Who's ever going to be like, you know what, I'm going to go work with them because they seem trustworthy.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no.
Exactly. And it's not like the first time these founders, you know, are like, haven't done anything shady. So at least from what I can understand, right? I don't want to.
And it's an HR company, like, yeah, right? Yeah, like, yeah. Focused on people. Like, the point is to be people focused. Yeah. I also think this goes back to the like leadership setting an example. If leadership is doing shady shit like this, of course accounting is going to cut corners. Of course marketing is going to be buying leads or doing shady shit that they shouldn't be doing or whatever. I think. Yeah. That sets the tone for everybody else. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever.
Totally. But I mean, also to be fair, I mean, I've been through some harrowing experiences when it comes to stuff like this, right? And I bet that 99% of the people at Rippling and Deal are great people working hard every day, right? And it's just like, it's such a shame for them that then suddenly they get painted with this nasty brush when they haven't done anything. I'm sure they're showing up every day working their ass off. When I was at WeWork, everybody, I was so proud of the way that people showed up, even during this firestorm where every news article was about how shitty we were. They still showed up and did the best work every day. It's really hard to do when there's just such much going on around you.
I was going to ask you about crisis communications, given the insane story that we just talked about. But honestly, I feel so badly for, if they do have a crisis comms team, I feel badly for them because they're in a no-win situation, quite honestly. All they can do is slightly lessen the impact, but ever so slightly.
It and really I can isn't. bet you $1,000 that if they had known about this plan to send in espionage, they'd be like, let's not do that. Yeah. Can we talk to legal first? No, let's not do that.
We're going to have That's what I'm saying. I think probably 99% of people did not know this was happening or would never endorse it, right? There's probably some shady manager somewhere who had said this was a good idea to send in a spy. I just assume I have no inside knowledge.
And there's it's just for like, sure it's gonna be a movie one day.
Yeah. I saw a headline. I think it was in some San Francisco journal. I think maybe it was San Francisco Journal, said like the most boring corporate drama ever to play out. like two HR companies duking it out. I'm like,
not boring though. It's spicy. And you know we're going to find out way more shady stuff.
Yeah, we are.
How does this idea even come to fruition? To the point that it actually is executed on? Like, I've been in a lot of rooms where bad ideas are tossed around. And somebody always shuts it down. But clearly there were no
guards. All I know is I never want to find myself with my laptop locked in a bathroom where people are banging on the door trying to get me out to see what I have on my laptop. I never want to be in that position. Oh my
God. He said, I will go to prison rather than give you my phone. So, okay.
He said that?
So,
wow,
like, yes,
okay, that makes wild.
Arrest me, you can't have my phone. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
So I'm gonna switch. We have a rapid fire round of questions, Robin, that we're gonna throw at you because we do that to all of our guests, at least in the early episodes here. We'll see how you do. You ready for these?
I'm so ready. Let's bring it on.
All right. What's a myth or misconception about communications or marketing in your case that drives you bananas?
Especially around communication, is that it's easy. It's not easy. I mean, I'll say this. I've become a good communicator because I fucking practiced over and over and over and over again. I had so many failures early on where I bombed presentations, like bombed interviews. Those are great lessons. And it really tells you, you got to practice. This is not, yes, of course, some people have it more easy. I get that. But in general, it's really hard. You got to practice. You got to learn how to, something sounds, how to communicate with emotion, with impact, all that stuff. It's not easy. I think a lot of people think, oh, this person just can do it. Oh, that CEO is great. I'm like,
they're a natural.
They practice. They practice.
yeah, for sure. All right. You get to wipe out one corporate buzzword from existence. You get to axe it right now. What do you kill?
OKRs. I just think it's it's just one of the most uninspiring ways to kind of try to motivate people. Yes, I am all for like alignment and clarity and goals, but like this OKRs, it just drives like this very, I think, short-sighted behavior in many ways. Because it's always like, hey, what's your quarterly OKR versus like taking a longer view that's aligned to something much more inspiring and motivational. And I totally get the value of an OKR. I'm not trying to be an idiot around that. It's just, I just think that there's, here in 2025, can't we do better? Can't we find something a little bit more inspiring for people? When was the last time you wrote an OKR and you were just like, fire? They are. What?
Yes.
Amazing.
All right. You're about to give a huge presentation, packed stadium, 50,000 people. What's the song you walk out to? What's the song you're going to hype yourself up with?
My walk on song would be High Hopes for the Living by Panic at the Disco.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Is there a walk off song you had in mind?
If yes, I would probably say Time of Your Life by Green Day.
Ooh, there you go. I like that.
Tell the whole story. Inspirational.
Feel good.
Well, it's just like it's like an acoustic, like winding down, like ensuring that everyone had a good time, you know, that it was memorable and valuable and worthwhile. I love, it's one of my favorite songs. You know, I'm of that generation. Green Day is probably one of my top three favorite bands of all time. I've seen them so many times. The best concert ever was in Oakland when I was living in California. It's just like seeing them in their home turf was amazing. So, but they're just great. They just, they speak to me.
Yeah. I would say they're a top 10 of mine. Very cool. Yeah. All right. You have to give a TED talk on something that isn't in your wheelhouse about, you know, marketing or comms or any of that. TED talk and you're going to captivate an audience. What's the topic?
It's fairly simple for me. It's kind of what I spend my life doing and focusing on is how to live an epic life, how to live a life of purpose, fulfillment, joy that's full of courage and adventure. And so you don't have anything left at the end of your life. I don't want to waste a second. I don't want to miss opportunities. I think you should go out there. Life is short. It doesn't mean that everything will work out, but you have to be vulnerable, authentic, and just go for it.
I love that word courage. I always say, if you're scared, cool. Do it scared. And I think that's the difference between those who do and those who do not. Right. Awesome. All right. You get to use one emoji until the end of time. Only one. What do you choose?
Bicep one.
Courage. That's a surprise one. Is that just because you're like, yes, today is an awesome day?
Yes, exactly. I'm always like pumped. I'm pumped up. I like to respond to that when people ask me things. I'm like pumped up. I get pumped about a lot of things, Becca, so.
I like that. No, I think that's a great choice. I think it was unexpected. I think it's awesome. Excellent. And totally on brand for you, I think. That's nailed.
I wish you had a jumping with arms out emoji, but they don't have that yet. So.
They have with like fire in the background. So, Becca, do you want to ask the last one?
This is Perry's add-on to our rapid fire question. So I would just like to caveat with blame Perry for this, but... You can either have hiccups nonstop for 3 months or 6 months, 3 months, or you cut off your own pinky.
I mean, what kind of psycho question is this? How is this even a question? Who would take the short term pain or some hiccups to keep your pinky?
Our last guest. Our last guest was ready to cut his pinky off on the show. Like he's like, get rid of the pinky.
That's permanent. I love my pinky. What the hell?
He didn't like his pinky. That's the thing. He didn't like his pinky. So he didn't care.
You're going to get rid of your pinky too, Becca, right? Didn't you say that?
What?
Didn't you say you'd chop off your pinky?
Yes. Have you guys ever had hiccups for extended periods of time? I've had hiccups for days at a time. That shit hurts and it makes life miserable.
But for 3 months. For three months.
But here's the thing. I would rather just pick death. I'm like a total wimp. Like, I am not a survivor in that way. I'm like, you know what? Cap me out. Give me the cyanide pill. Or like, throw me in the garage with the engine running. And I pick death. Yeah.
This is one of the reasons, honestly, I try to put myself in extreme situations and do like endurance sports. Because it's not because I'm very good at it, to be honest. It's because to remind myself I can endure anything. I'm like, Like 3 months of this sounds horrible, but I could probably endure it.
Brother, my whole family chose to get rid of their pinky instead of
having. What?
I'm like, what are you people? You're choosing mutilation?
Perry, what are we missing, you and I? I feel like we're not on the same page with everybody here.
I don't know. I value every one of my digits a lot.
But maybe the truth is, Becca, I've actually not had the hiccups in a long time, so I've maybe forgotten how painful they are. I don't know.
I mean, they're not always painful, but I think if you had them for 3 months, they would be. An angry diaphragm is nobody's friend.
Which, by the way, is a hell of a metal band.
Yeah.
Angry diaphragm?
Angry diaphragm.
Well, can you sleep with hiccups? Is that been proven?
Yeah, I mean, it probably poorly.
Probably poorly, yeah. I don't know if I can. My sleep is very important to me. I mean, I have my sleep ring now. Yeah. And really, my son is always making fun of me because he calls it my mood ring, which is really, really embarrassing. But
also, we're going to pinky promise. I mean, come on.
It's true.
You're not wearing it on your pinky, so you're good there.
Oh my God. All right. This has been a lot of fun, Robin. Yeah, we appreciate you showing up very much. I'm glad your voice is back. It's great to connect with you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Good to see you both.
Thanks, Robin.
Thank you.